Welcome to Tales from the Doghouse, Separation Anxiety Explained. I am Sarah McLaren. I'm based in the UK at Separation Anxiety Solutions, and with me is the wonderful...
Hello, it's Ness Jones here from Australia, and I am also from Separation Anxiety in Dogs Decoded. And who else are we joined by today?
It's me. It's Stacey Bell from Focused Fun. In the U.S. Today, we are talking all about chronic stress in dogs. What are some of the effects of chronic stress or toxic stress, and what we can do about it?
Yeah, and not just dogs, people too. The dog's people. Because if a dog has separation anxiety, then it's quite stressful for the people as well, so they can suffer from chronic stress.
It quite stressful could almost be an understatement, really, couldn't it, with some of our poor clients?
Yeah.
So let's define chronic stress.
As opposed to acute stress.
Yes, let's do that first as a activity.
As an activity. All right. So... acute stress is kind of like the fight, flight, and freeze that we talk here about. And acute stress is something that is fleeting. It's like if you're one of those antelopes on the savannah and there's a lion chasing after you, you would face acute stress. Or if you nearly have a car accident, that might be acute stress, but it goes away. Whereas chronic stress is more ongoing.
Yeah, I think that's the main distinction there is the ongoingness of it.
Yeah, so our bodies are designed for acute stress and to get into that fight, flight, and freeze demeanor. What's the right word? Physiological response. But not to be in that state, you know, constantly. It's really bad for us and it can impact our health.
This is why we've all had such a struggle with COVID, isn't it? Because it's constant, chronic, underlying stress that we can't do anything about.
Yeah. So I actually have some of the effects of chronic stress. I've actually got an article here, which I shall link in the show notes, but it was on Healthline. So the body releases adrenaline and cortisol, which is the stress hormone. And these hormones are released very quickly and can affect the heart rate. This is when we get our pounding heart, the lungs, which is where we get rapid breathing, eyes, our pupils can dilate, ears, our hearing becomes sharper, blood thickens and increases to major muscles, skin and pain perception. And I think this is really interesting because I wonder with the pain perception, why that might mean that dogs hurt themselves and when they're panicking and they don't feel that pain, like they can break out of crates and cut their face, or they can try and escape the yard and cut themselves up really badly, or jump out of second floor windows, which we've heard about, and it happens. And I wonder if that's because their pain perception's not as heightened. They can also get stomach ache, tummy issues, and which I think might explain why they perhaps can't control their bowels. If they've got, you know, tummy issues.
Right. Well, and it also suppresses the immune system and other systems that aren't essential for short-term survival.
Yeah.
I do think that also when we're looking at our dogs, and especially in the context of separation anxiety, it can also damage relationships you know, just that chronic stress, it changes your mood and your perception of yourself and other people and situations. And so that can be really damaging. In dogs, I think that constant state, well, people too, but since we're all about dogs here, I think it also increases the probability of inappropriate behavior or, you know, sometimes aggression or reactivity in dogs. So there's that too.
Yeah. So there's a vet called Kirsty, but it's a really weird spelling. So I should put this in the show note. Sexcel, I think she's a BB. And she's talking about stress. Her article is called Stress and Anxiety, How Do They Impact the Pet? And she says, apart from behavioral problems such as separation anxiety and noise phobias, the underlying reason for many cases that present in general practice with recurrent medical problems such as vomiting, diarrhea, and skin problems may be related to anxiety, which is really interesting, I think. So I think one, you know, a lot of dogs that maybe are suffering from stress can get skin problems and vomiting and diarrhea.
From the you were saying about, you know, the behavioral impact of anxiety on your dogs, and the when it's chronic, when it goes on day after day after day, and the way that it impacts on the human beings as well, because it's very, very difficult for a pet parent to have empathy or sympathy for their dog going through all the different behavioral I can't think of the word now, but you know, the all this anxiety and everything that they're doing. And when we are too, and we, when we're so close and we can't develop sympathy or empathy, then we start to, you know, it does, it ruins the relationship. Like you just said, it affects relationships between pet parents and dogs massively, because for us sitting on the outside, we can have sympathy for them because we're not in there, but for them, it becomes very, very difficult.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's especially more difficult when you don't understand that the behavior is not a decision. The dog is not trying to be bad or get back at you or any of that. It's just like truly the behavioral fallout of the chronic stress.
I'm glad you said that, Stacey, because this article goes on to say, I won't read it all out, but just that the dog, when it's in a highly emotional state, the limbic activation is high. Yes. And what happens is that when they are experiencing fear or stress, that limbic system, which is the emotional brain, overrides the cortical system, which is the logical thinking brain. So that makes sense why the dog might do behaviors that it wouldn't normally do when the owner's out, because it can't help it, basically. Mm.
Yeah.
Even though it knows it's wrong, don't eat the couch.
As a pet parent looking at your dog, how do you know, is my dog experiencing normal stress that, you know, everybody feels stress in their lives. There's going to be times that they're frustrated or whatever. Or when it's tipping over into more of a chronic stress, like, are there different things that people would be looking for or seeing? So I think one of them is how often are you seeing your dog react with anxious body language? And we've kind of talked about body language and behaviors that might be associated with anxiety in a couple episodes ago. So revisiting that and just observing your dog, how often are they in that state? If your dog is tends to, I'm going to do quotes here, but you guys can't see it, overreact to things, or if they're kind of like jumpy, then to me that would suggest a frame of mind that they're in more of a constant state of stress, or hypervigilance is another one. Irritability, just, you know, if your dog just seems kind of fussy all the time, that could be a sign. And just for our purposes, also to remember that dogs that are in a state of chronic stress do have a difficulty learning, right? So then that makes our job as trying to show them that being home alone is safe more difficult.
There's another sign amongst all those, which is the excessive grooming.
Yeah, so that's exactly where I was going as well, Sarah. So this article says that some of the behaviors that may be exhibited are changes in appetite, so decrease in appetite or pica. Grooming, usually increased, exactly what you said. Elimination, urination or defecation. Social interactions, e.g. Vocalization, increased or decreased contact, and physical activity, increased or decreased. Because it's an altered state of homeostasis, which can cause physical or emotional factors that trigger psychological, behavioral, endocrine and immune effects. Yeah, that are designed to handle stress. It's quite impactful, isn't it, when you think about it? I mean, apart from the physical ailments, the mental ones, and then the effect on the immune system as well.
Yeah. So I think, well, in lifespan, did we mention that?
Yes. No, not yet.
Oh, not well, yet. Spoiler alert. It shortens lifespan.
Yeah.
And I think that we really do have to think of it as a welfare issue, right? Because it affects just about every aspect of the dog's life and your life, really. For the most part, when I see families with a dog that's really struggling, they are also really struggling.
Yeah.
It's not very common for the dog to be really struggling and the people to be kind of like blowing it off, right? So I think it kind of bleeds together there.
Yeah, this vet, and I actually posted this on my social media yesterday because I thought it was a good quote. The longer that anxiety-related conditions are unrecognized and untreated, the more complex they become and potentially the more difficult they are to treat.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really, one message that I would send to pet parents is that if you are concerned about your dog's behavior or you see something, and I'm not just talking about with separation related behaviors, but any behavior that you're seeing in your dog that you don't know how to work through or you're not sure about, get help sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
It doesn't get easier to work through the more that your dog has practiced that behavior, right? So just getting on top of it, even if it just seems like kind of a small thing at the time, but you're just a little bit uncomfortable with it or you wish it wasn't there, just get help right away. You will.
And it doesn't just go away. Things like that don't just go away. They don't just get better. You know, it's like, oh, we'll wait a couple of months because, oh, we'll wait a couple of weeks. And all this time that you wait, like you say, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And we find that so many people get in touch with us when they're at the point of, you know, just not knowing what to do anymore, at the point where they might, you know, they're thinking of rehoming their animals or, you know, even behavioral euthanasia is, you know, another big one, particularly with massively stressed out dogs. So it's, as Stacey says, get in touch.
Did you know, here's an interesting fun fact for you. So we were talking about the link between owners and humans and how the dog stress can impact the human stress. But think on this. So if the dog's stressed and has separation anxiety and that makes the human stressed, actually what then happens is you've got a cyclical effect because according to neurobiologists, I shall put it in the show notes.
What's his face?
I can't pronounce it, all right? He's from the University of Naples.
Professor, what's his face?
Anyway, he did a study, right? And it was designed to examine a new perspective, namely the transmission of emotional states from humans to dogs via human body odor, produced using happiness and fear. So they got 40 Labrador retrievers and golden retrievers, and the dogs' behaviors and physiological responses changed as a result of exposure to emotionally tinged sweat-related odors. And the dogs that were exposed to fear-related, now this does say fear, not anxiety, but you can imagine if they can pick up on our happiness and our fear, they can pick up on our anxiety, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shows more behavioral signs of stress than those exposed to the happy or neutral smells. And then it says these dogs, I think this is really important, these dogs seem to be also seeking reassurance through contact with their owners. So if we look at it this way, we've got a dog that's stressed, the human then gets stressed, and then the dog picks up on the human stress. So I feel it could be like a catch 22, you know, it's going round and round in circles. Yeah.
Like a loop, right?
And another interesting fun fact is apparently female dogs have a stronger connection to their owner's stress level compared with male dogs. However, you guys and I know that apparently, anecdotally, I don't think there's been any major research into this, that it's male dogs that have more separation anxiety than
females. I think so there was a study and the male dogs was slightly higher.
Yeah, only slightly, but yeah. So it's interesting that they came up with that. That was by Sundman, that one, I think.
The other side, I mean, when you look at the other side of that coin, I mean, obviously, if you've got a dog that's stressed and then you've got a human that's stressed and you get this cyclical effect, but then we also use dogs to help humans that live with high stress levels. So, we use dogs to help people with autism. So, you know, the opposite of that is that we do have some dogs that are incredibly well able to cope with the stress of their human and even, you know, help their human feel better.
Yes.
So it's not always the bad side of things, is it? Sometimes it's the good side. But yeah, I think, and you know yourself, if you've ever done anything that's terrified you, you know, the smell of sweat that comes from adrenaline and fear rather than just being warm is a whole different ball game. I think even we could detect that one. I think you'd have to stand too close.
There's a study by Sundman in 2019 about the long-term stress synchronization in dogs and their owners. And
Didn't we talk about that in our other podcast about humans and that study? Go ahead.
It might be worth revisiting. They studied 58 dogs, analyzed their hair cortisol concentrates. They used a dog personality questionnaire and a survey, and they also monitored the dog's activity via a cloud-based activity collar for 1 week, which is very long. The key findings were that although dogs' personalities had little effects on their hair cortisol concentrations, the human personality traits, neuroticism, conscientiousness, and openness significantly affected the dog's hair cortisol concentrations. Hence, they suggest that dogs, to a great extent, mirror the stress levels of their owners. Stress contagion can occur between two species as measured by cognitive performance. And lastly, the facts that short-term stress seems contagious between dogs and owners and that dogs share their owners' everyday life could lead to an interspecific long-term stress hormone synchronization. I find that really interesting.
Yeah.
And especially interesting from what you're saying, Sarah, with obviously the therapy dogs, like, because that is almost inverse, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of research going on. Well, not research, but I know that there's different bodies who deal with animals who, animal assistance, or is it animal intervention, they call it? Because some companies are not quite so good at recognizing whether the dogs are actually stressed by the activity of being, you know, going around hospitals and things like that. Whereas there's another, you know, other bodies that are looking more into actually, is this really what our dogs are good at? Is this really what they're enjoying, or are they just coping with it? And that's another thing, you know, we need to be sure that our dogs are actually really are feeling better and not just coping, not hiding under the sofa or under the bed or something where it looks like they're okay and actually they're not. And speaking of stress, I can throw this one at you because I know, you know, I like to throw the odd thing at you on a weekly basis just to make you go, what? So when we talk about
stress, it's not another snake, is it? It's not another snake, is it?
My darling husband at the age of 49 had a massive heart attack.
Oh, wow.
And that was stress. He wasn't overweight. Yeah. He didn't, you know, there was nothing that he did. He was, he did smoke, and the action of smoking, they say, causes stress in your body. But he was very much a stress head, and he still is quite stressy. So I blame him if my dogs are stressed, because I'm not.
It can't
be me.
There was another study that I came across that was actually an easy name, Lisa Wallace et al. I only quote studies where I can pronounce people's names.
I think I've read that one.
We might end up missing some really good studies here if we're only going on short, nice, easy names.
I'm just kidding. This one actually, I came across it kind of weirdly, but anyways, it's called the Demographic Change Across the Lifespan of Pet Dogs and Their Impact on Health Status. So it was an interesting study in itself, but they were talking about things that contribute to our dogs' health over time and aging and all of that kind of stuff. And so the big ones were like things that you would expect, obesity and whether they're mixed breeds or purebred, blah, blah, blah. But one of the big things was trauma and chronic stress. So that was a interesting one. But it kind of got me down the road of thinking, especially since we like to offer possible solutions to our listeners about, you know, what are the different things that we would suggest for our listeners to help their dogs not be stuck in this place of chronic stress, right? So I thought that that would be a useful way for us to kind of be solution seekers in this world.
Yeah, so I mean, apart from the things that we can give tips to our listeners in terms of the dogs, I think we also need to talk about the relationship between the owner and the dog. And so I like to tell people, you know, go for a walk in nature with the dog and just spend some time together, go and have some fun together, maybe go to the beach or go to the park or do some trick training together, do something that enriches your lives together, so that bond is still strong and not diminished because everybody's stressed out of their heads, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And in terms of the owner, you know, if they're into it, maybe do some meditation or some yoga. Make sure both dog and human are getting some adequate exercise, because exercise is a really good stress reliever. Listen to some nice music together, you know, all that sort of.
Doga, what about dog yoga?
Dog yoga, yes. A fun exercise to do together. But keeping for the human in particular, you know, looking after themselves and being, looking after their physical and their mental health as well.
Yeah. It's funny that you say about the meditation, Ness, because I have a client who was noticing that as she was getting ready for an exercise with her dog, that she was starting to get anxious, right? Because she was, you know, they're in a good spot, but, you know, she was worried about having a blip or, you know, all that kind of stuff. So
makes sense.
She puts brown noise on to mask some environmental noises. And I know that she and her dog really like to go to the sea and enjoy the ocean and long walks and stuff. So I had her suggested that she do this whole you know, like as you're getting ready, listen to the brown noise, let that remind you of the sea and do nice deep breathing and all this stuff. And I thought she was going to laugh at me, you know, because it's like kind of outside of my area of expertise, but I was going with it. And she said she really liked it and it really did help her kind of ground herself and get ready for the training. So she's been adding that. Yes.
Stacey, as a suggestion, when you were saying that about, you know, going to the sea and putting some music on, I was actually starting to feel really, really relaxed. So what I would suggest is perhaps that you should put on some soothing music in the background and do an audio tape for her. Ooh. And send her an audio file. Now, dear client, I want you to take a deep breath in and a deep breath out. I think that's a really good added bonus that you could offer your clients.
Yes.
So isn't this meant to be before she goes for a walk, though? Wasn't that before she goes for a walk?
No, that was before she did a home alone exercise.
All right. I was going to say, you don't be wanting to do that before you go out, do you? She'll be asleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, but it's a good point. So because even when I'm like just training my dogs at my club, I get stressed before I start a training exercise because I've got it in my head that I always want to succeed and I want my dog to succeed, which actually I don't actually do now with my obedience. I don't mind if my dog fails because it's a learning experience. But of course, when we're doing separation anxiety training, we don't want them to fail at all, do we? We always want them to succeed. So I think I can understand why clients would get maybe a little bit icky, if that's the right word, or a bit worried about doing the training pre-training. Makes sense.
I'm gonna say, I think if I could give my clients any gift, it would be that the gift of coping with the variability and coping with the fact that there's ups and downs in training without getting too upset about it, because I think that's the worst thing. We know it's going to happen because we see it day in and day out. Right. And with, you know, dogs over and over again. But for that, again, I think I've mentioned this before, for that one client, it's their one dog. And for them, it's heartbreaking. And if, we could take that away or take that feeling away from them, that'd be great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think kind of along those lines is just being able to read your dog, right? So we talked about this in the body language podcast that we did. But if you don't know what your dog looks like when they're fearful or anxious, then you being able to step in and mitigate that is not real likely. So that's a really important step in it as well.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, ensuring the dogs had plenty of enrichment and mental stimulation is so important, that they're having a good diet.
That's where your professional help comes in as well, because if you've never had a dog before and your dog is on that side of anxiety and they've got separation anxiety and all these other things, you quite often don't know what I'm doing the air quotes now, quite often don't know what a normal dog would look like because you've only got your own dog to compare it with. So that, you know, without, when you then work with a professional, they can watch your dog and go, actually, we know that's not great. There's things that we can help you with.
Well, and then the really obvious one that we talk about frequently, but is definitely worth mentioning again here, is to help your dog feel safe, right? So your dog can't learn that being home alone is safe if they're experiencing over threshold experiences where it's scary. So that's one thing. If your dog has anxiety surrounding other things in addition to being home alone, then addressing those things and using management and training where you can there as well.
Yeah. Confidence building things, exercises are important for those dogs that have got generalized anxiety. What would be interesting to know is how many dogs with separation anxiety also have some form of generalized anxiety, because they're the ones that really are at risk of chronic stress.
I was just consulting with another trainer on a couple of her cases, and both of them have, you know, separation anxiety, hyperattachment, reactivity to multiple triggers. And I'm just like, tell me they're on medication, please. Please tell me they're on medication. But it's true, when a dog kind of tips over to having that generalized anxiety and the whole world feels like it's against them, then that is something that can really, really help make a difference is A, stopping the fear for the things that you know about, but then also speaking with a vet to get medication to support you through that, or your dog through that. And you, maybe you also need medication.
I think, Sarah, you said that you had a client, or maybe more than one, that was also on the same medication as the dog.
It wouldn't be unheard of for them to be on the same anxiety medication, particularly as certain ones over here are basically the same medication. It's just that the vets use them off license. So yeah, it wouldn't be unheard of at all. Although I would not recommend going off to the chemist and coming home with something over the counter and giving it to your dog.
So which came first then? The human's anxiety or the dog's anxiety?
Ooh. Do you know, I've never actually asked that. Although most clients, when they come to me, the dogs are not on medication. It's very, very rare that you get them that are already on medication by the time mm-hmm. they get to you. Normally it kind of like starts around the same time, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's another thing. You know, if I had a choice between a dog on medication and a dog not, I'd quite happily have the one on medication, because so far in my experience the ones on medication just do so much better.
I think that's something we should talk about too. So the effects of chronic stress, obviously we've talked about how it can impact their health and even their lifespan, and of course we also get pushback from a lot of owners about medication. I don't want my dog to be a zombie, blah 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 blah. And yet we also have to look at, well, if we don't do something about this chronic stress, you're going to have a dog's that's not going to last as long, you know, that it's going to really seriously impact their health. As Stacey says, it is a welfare issue for those dogs, and that, mm-hmm. that medication might be the thing that really helps.
Yeah. I think that many people, objection, like you said, to meds is that they feel like it's going to change their dog's personality and make them a zombie dog or super lethargic, and I think it's worth just putting out there that that's not the goal of medication. The goal of medication isn't that it sedates your dog, or at least the medication that we're talking about here. Certainly there are times when vets would use a sedative. But in the cases that we're talking about for separation related behaviors, we're talking about, you know, something that will help balance the neurochemistry so your dog isn't anxious, right? Mm. And I think what most people find is that their dog is their same dog, but maybe can now play with toys or can interact more easily with people, can learn more easily, can relax and sleep more deeply. I mean, I think those are the things that people will see as changes in their dog. And to me, those are all positive changes.
Mm. It's nothing to be afraid of, is it? And if things don't look as rosy as you hoped they would, then you can just speak to your vet, because I don't know how many medications are out there.
So many.
Yeah. So it's just hitting the right one, isn't it? And some people mm-hmm. are lucky to get it the right one straight off, but other ones, they either have to adjust the dosage or adjust the medication, or mm-hmm. and just keep that open dialogue with their vet.
Another thing that I think that people mistakenly do is when they're trying to help their dogs over their fears, they'll force them to face the fears. Like I had a client that it was before that I switched over to only taking separation anxiety cases, but this dog was generally fearful and they wanted to teach the dog to swim. So their idea was to carry him out into the water and drop him in. And I'm like,
I hate that. And then they wonder why their dog hates the water.
Yeah. And so I was like, please don't do that. Please don't do that. And so we came up with a different plan that was a gradual approach, you know, working at the dog's pace, that kind of thing. And just having the dog around other dogs that love the water. And, you know, that helps so much. But I think people mistakenly feel like, well, if I take my dog out to the water and drop them in, they'll realize that, you know, that it's okay. And you're like, no, that's not their experience at that moment though, you know? And so that's more of a, you know, a flooding type of thing. And so, not helpful because it can really end up sensitizing the dog or making them worse.
So we should tell our listeners what flooding is, Stacey, if we're going to talk about flooding. But I guess in terms of separation anxiety, that flooding would be the kind of, oh, let them bark it out sort of thinking.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Sarah?
I was going to say the dropping them in the water. I mean, that would definitely be a case of acute stress.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Panic, absolute panic. So Stacey, do you want to tell our listeners what flooding is?
Sure. So, flooding is when, so in contrast to we use, you know, a gradual approach where we're we're exposing the dog to the scary thing at a really low frequency and a really low intensity, at a level that the dog can handle without going over threshold or showing signs of anxiety. And so the flooding is kind of like on the other end of the spectrum than that. And it's when you basically expose the dog or person or whatever to the thing that they're afraid of full force, in hopes that they'll realize that it's not scary. In human psychology, I think it's used sometimes. I think most people would, I think the difference between using flooding with people and using flooding with dogs is that with people, you can say, this is going to be the biggest intensity of what you are most afraid of. But we're hoping that when you get to the other side of it, you'll see that you were in fact okay. And so you can kind of A, get consent to do that, and B, kind of talk them through the logic. And in dogs, you can't do that, right? And so the talking them through why this, you know, quote unquote would work, it can't really be done in dogs.
Yeah. So I'm scared of cockroaches and I'm scared of lifts. I've got claustrophobia, so I don't want to get locked in anything. So for flooding, you would throw me in a lift. Full of cockroaches.
Full of cockroaches, yeah.
And I guess what? That would not solve my issues.
It made me think of, I think it's I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, which is filmed in the lovely country that you're in, when they stick them in boxes full of cockroaches and things like that. And when you watch some people, and I watch some of them and think, they are going to be having PTSD at some point from this, because they're clearly absolutely terrified. And it's that, and I can't imagine the nightmares they must have afterwards. And these are human beings that can have cognitive thoughts. You know, we can think about, I know what they are, I know they can't hurt me, blah, 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 blah. And even then we would still be terrified. And your poor dog, you can't explain anything like that to your dog, can you?
No.
Yeah, I think, I think it may work because I do think they still use it in psychology today with people.
Do they? I thought with phobias today, they used more of a gradual technique.
I think they do. I think mostly they do, but I think that some some people still lean the flooding way because it's quick, right? You know,
ripping off a Band-Aid.
So if it does work, it's quick. If it doesn't work, then it's set you way back, right? So it's a big risk. And that's with people, of course, where you can explain
what's happening.
And I think that I wonder if it works more with quote unquote more irrational fears. And I'm doing the quotes around the irrational because, like, I'm trying to think of what I would consider an irrational fear. Like, I think being trapped in a small space with cockroaches all around, like, even if I didn't have like a cockroach aversion, that would be like really scary.
You'd have one after that.
Yeah, I would have one after that. So I'm just trying to think of like, what's that, Sarah?
I mean, being, you know, cockroaches and lifts, I mean, that's pretty irrational, isn't it? That being stuck in a small space. And
yeah,
I don't think I think the ones like fear of paper or fear of ice cream, those kind of things, they're the ones that are truly, they're really irrational. Fear of
carrots. Right. And so I wonder if it's more likely that fears like that would be overcome with flooding. I don't know if there's a study on that or not, but to the person experiencing that fear, it's very real. So I don't know.
I've got a word for you. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I think this is right. Anyway, lacanophobia.
What?
Lacanophobia. Lacanophobia. An irrational fear of vegetables.
Vegetables.
Yeah.
I definitely don't have that fear.
I mean, I know I'm laughing, but can you imagine having that? I mean, having a lacanophobic individuals naturally try to avoid vegetable aisles in grocery stores. I mean, can you imagine being afraid of vegetables? I mean, I know that we're laughing, but that must be like, really?
Yeah.
For want of a better word, you know, pants. Especially if you've got kids and you're trying to make them eat healthy by eating vegetables, but you can't go anywhere near them. That must be interesting.
So what are other things that we could suggest? We already suggested the professional help thing. I think if you have a fearful dog, whether it's separation, I mean, I think we're just generally looking at a dog that is fearful or has chronic stress to work with a professional. I think that in the end, the guidance that the professional would be able to provide would just help your training be more efficient.
And try to look at the things that your dog is doing from a place of fear and anxiety. So when they're pooping your hallway, they're not doing it to get back at you. When they eat your sofa, they're not doing it to get back at you. When they, you know, pee all over your rug, they're not doing it to get back at you. This comes from a place of real, genuine fear and anxiety. And if you can engender that sympathy for them, that will help you massively. And then to try and mitigate the things that make them stressful. So, you know, don't leave them on their own. If you can find a way of getting around that and giving them someone else to stay with while you go somewhere, then do that. If they're noise sensitive, then find a way of blocking out that noise. If they've got visual sensitivities, then cover your windows. You know, all the things that we've probably talked about in a lot of episodes, you know, all those things all come together to try and help your dog deal with this particular ongoing chronic stress that's caused by separation anxiety.
Right, right. And also to remember that it's a long haul.
Yeah, it's not a quick fix. There's no magic pills.
Who's got the birdie outside the window?
It's got to be
a little birdie.
Oh, it's just after sunrise, so the birds are out.
You should do these sitting on your balcony watching the sun come up. Would that not be nicer?
It's a little bit chilly at the moment.
Is it? What? How chilly is it, Ness?
Right this minute. Gosh, I'm not sure. Hang on, let me have a look. It's probably around, I imagine, 10 or 11. So.
Oh, that is chilly. That's almost a cool.
It says here 7, so, but I don't know how accurate that is.
That would require early to wear a coat.
For the US people, that would be 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Just
okay.
Help. Just, you know, conversion. Conversion helps.
Yeah, I'm wondering at what point in the next century America's going to go metric and actually get in line with the rest of the world.
Yeah, I hear you. Oh, the one thing that I wanted to bring up, just because I think it's one of those, what did we call them? Misconceptions.
Misconceptions.
Is the whole thing of you can't comfort your dog because you'll reinforce the fear.
Good point.
So, and I think this kind of goes back to what you were saying, Ness, about one of the studies that you're talking about early on in this episode is that, you know, being a secure base for your dog. So there's been studies with people and dogs about how when something fearful or something that's happening that they're fearful of, that you being there helps the dog feel better, right? So some dogs will feel better being cuddled or stroked, or and some dogs may want to hide. But the big thing is that you're your dog's person. And so if they're coming to you seeking comfort, it's absolutely okay for you to comfort your dog. It's not going to make them more afraid of the thing that they were afraid of. It's not going to, it's just going to make them feel better in that situation.
Ernie's really good at that. Being a small dog, it was always really important when we got him as a puppy that I taught him that being picked up was a good thing. So we did lots of work of being picked up and, you know, and getting rewarded for it and things like that. So now if he is in trouble, the first thing he does is come to me and ask me to pick him up. And he will ask me in a specific way to let me know that he wants me to pick him up. And all that's ever done is made him more confident and given him somewhere safe to go. And he very rarely, you know, you see other dogs that when they're frightened, they just leg it. His first place is coming back to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, it's important that they see you as a place of safety.
Hey, lovely listeners. Thanks so much for listening again this week. Just to kind of reiterate, toxic stress or chronic stress is super, super bad for your dog. It's a big welfare concern, but also inhibits their ability to learn, has health implications, and shortens their lifespan. So we want to really make sure that we are on top of that. And we offered lots and lots of advice on how to mitigate the effects of chronic stress and help your dog overcome it. Thanks for listening. My name is Stacey Bell and I am at Focused Fun. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Focused Fun Dogs, and my website is focusedfun.net.
And you've been listening to me, Sarah McLaren from the UK. I'm at Separation Anxiety Solutions and you can find me on Instagram and Facebook. And my website at www.separationanxietysolutions.com.
And I'm Ness Jones. I'm in Australia from Separation Anxiety in Dogs Decoded. And you can find me on Facebook as well as Instagram, which is _NessJones_. You have been listening to Tales from the Doghouse, Separation Anxiety Explained. You can find us on Google, Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, and other listening apps. Please like us, share us, and give us a 5-star review. We shall see you next week. Bye.
Bye.